Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. We're doing a series of reports from the Drug Policy Alliance Conference from Long Beach, California. I urge you to tune in to our website, drugtruth.net, to hear more of them. I invite you to listen to this week's Century of Lies, which features a speech by Ethan Nadelman, the director of the Drug Policy Alliance. This program will be a magazine, if you will, featuring many voices who spoke at the Drug Policy Alliance Conference. I'll start this off with a story most of you are familiar with. Up in Denver, a new organization, SAFER, pushed forward a resolution that the voters of Denver passed to allow adults to legally possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana. I'm here with Mr. Mason Tavert, the executive director of SAFER Alternatives for Enjoyable Recreation. Tell us about the initiative and the results and what it means.
What we did was we have amended the Denver City Ordinance to wipe out all civil and criminal penalties for possession of less than an ounce of marijuana for adults over 21 years old. And this is the first city in the country to do so, to remove all penalties. And what our message has been is that it really makes absolutely no sense to prohibit adults from making the rational, safer decision to use marijuana instead of alcohol. And currently we have laws that foster this so-called culture of alcohol and push adults towards using a drug that's more harmful than they might otherwise choose to use. And it's really what it comes down to is it's not good public policy. It needs to be changed, and people are fed up with it. And the people of Denver spoke very loud and clear about that at this recent election. 53%, even a little more, 53.5%, voted to remove these penalties because they are fed up with a system that does not allow them to make a safer decision on behalf of what they put in their own body. And what it comes down to is our current laws are legislative morality, and they're picking and choosing what we should be able to put in our bodies and not. And what it comes down to is they're not even picking and choosing them well. They're allowing us to eat a drug that is far more damaging in that it leads to a number of serious societal problems in alcohol, such as domestic violence, violent crime, fighting, property damage, and all these. Yet none of these problems are associated with marijuana, and it seems strange that we have a government that continues to prohibit people from using marijuana when it doesn't cause these problems, yet it allows them to consume alcohol. And we think that's a poor decision on our nation's part, and we have taken the first step in pointing that out by passing this initiative. It's clearly inspired a number of folks to get involved at the level, and we definitely encourage people to do so because this is a bottom-up process. So we do not expect the federal government to simply withdraw from the war on marijuana. We're going to need to show them that they must withdraw from the war on marijuana, and there's no way to do that but to show what the people want. Unfortunately, this is not an issue where our elected officials are willing to stand up. At least most of them are not willing to stand up. And we need to show them that the people want this so that they are emboldened to stand up on behalf of their people. Unfortunately, the people in the officials in Denver are not quite as enlightened as the people of Denver, and they are not choosing to stand up for their people, which is where we stand right now. We're fighting for implementation of I-100 in Denver, and we plan to continue placing public pressure on the local officials and the mayor, who I should point out sells alcohol, a far more dangerous drug than marijuana. We are going to continue to implement this because they have every right to do so. They do not need to cite individuals. They do not need to prosecute under state law, which is what they say they're going to do. They have the choice to cite under municipal law and have those cases be dropped, and that's what we'd like to see. Spending far less of our time, our resources, and our lives on worrying about a drug less harmful than one you can buy at the grocery store.
I think most of you will recognize this next voice. You've heard his commercials many a time for the Men's Warehouse. He's one of the oft-time funders of drug reform. I'm here in Long Beach with Mr. George Zimmer. What was the reason that you got involved in helping to change people's minds about drugs?
Well, I really believe that the war on drugs, specifically the war against marijuana, has as unintended consequences some very serious negatives for our society. And I believe that our country would be much stronger if we would put marijuana in the same class as alcohol.
Now, the government talks about, you know, oh my gosh, there are people with money funding this, and yet the government spends perhaps 100 times more each year to maintain this status quo. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the status quo has always had its own power, and you can't complain about fighting the status quo, because all societal change requires changing the status quo. So it's just something that, whether it's the civil rights movement or the women's movement or the gay rights movement or the marijuana movement, you're always going to be fighting an uphill battle against greater resources.
Now, we heard from some of the panel discussions here today that the focus has changed over the years from marijuana per se to perhaps now overall drug reforms. Your thoughts, sir, is this a good and positive step?
You know, I believe that the end game, which may be decades away, will involve total legalization of all drugs, so that what we call illegal drugs will be treated just like the pharmaceuticals are today. I think that's decades away, and I really think that by focusing on marijuana, we have the opportunity to create some positive change within several years.
There's some squabbles between reform groups about how this money's spent. Your thoughts, sir, are we spending these funds properly?
Well, let me just say initially that although I know the three large funders of this movement, I am not one of those three. I'm not privy, therefore, to all of their discussions in which they're discussing tactics and strategy. I was impressed at the session that we just attended to see Ethan Nadelman and Rob Campia on the same platform, because they have had their disagreements over the years, and it seems that they're aligned and working together now. So although there is always going to be some inner discussion, I think that for the most part we are coming together in a cohesive and comprehensive way. I really do believe that we are going to win this war eventually. In fact, I guarantee it.
I'm August Delor from Amsterdam, Holland, and I'm advisor of the Ministry of Health of the Dutch government, and I'm also advisor of the City of Amsterdam in drugs policy.
And your assessment, the basic differences perhaps of the U.S. cities versus what goes on in Holland?
Yes. In Holland, we have what we call the pragmatic approach. We accept the use of drugs as a social, cultural phenomenon. And our programs are not based on repression and put people in jail, but it's based on healthcare. One of our programs is we have the coffee shops in Holland, and the coffee shop is one of the key strategy in the Dutch drugs policy to separate the selling of soft and hard drugs. You see, in Holland, when you want to buy cannabis, the hundred thousands of smokers of cannabis in whole Europe, and here in the USA there are millions of smokers of cannabis. In Holland, there is a safe place to buy your cannabis far away from the real hard drugs in the coffee shop. So we have more than 800 coffee shops in Holland, and I advise the coffee shop owners. We train the staff of coffee shops in prevention programs. There are flyers. When you come to the coffee shop and you want to buy your cannabis, there is a flyer with proper information about the use of cannabis. You see, don't use it at school, don't use it in the when you're driving, use it for fun, and when you are in problems, go to your local doctor. And every year more than 2.7 million flyers are spread out by the coffee shop owners, sponsored by the coffee shop owners. That's one of our programs.
Now, in the U.S., we hear many people in authority who say the Dutch have more crime, they have more drug use, they have more problems. What is your response to that?
That's not true. what we say in Holland is that after alcohol, the cannabis is the second drug in the society. You see? Instead of put the people in jail, give them the opportunity to have safe smoke. Safe smoke. In Holland, the use of soft drugs is much softer than here in the USA. And also the use of hard drugs in Holland is much softer. We have really less heroin users in Holland. You see? And also the heroin users are in direct contact with needle exchange programs, with methadone programs, with heroin prescription. They are not lying under the bridge. They are not lying and chasing by the police. They are not filling the jails. You see, they are in programs. They have still contact with the parents. We work on that. There are special programs when they want to stop. You see, with integrated programs, with the family are involved, the neighborhood programs. So the Dutch drug policy is based on harm reduction and pragmatic answers of the problems.
I'm here at the DPA conference with Mr. Ira Glasser, former head of the American Civil Liberties Union.
The basic thing to remember is that drug prohibition, whether you're for it or against it, is not evenly or fairly enforced. It is enforced primarily against blacks and Latinos. According to the government's own statistics, 13% of monthly drug users are black, which is about the same as their proportion in the population. But 37% of those arrested for drug offenses are black, 54% of those convicted for drug offenses are black, and 67%, two-thirds of everybody in prison for drug offenses is black. In some states, like New York, 92% of all the people who are in prison for drug offenses are black or Latino, despite the fact that 75% of all the drug users are white. So what you have is racial profiling, racial targeting, and as a result, one out of every three young black men are under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system. And because most states bar former felons from voting, it's also the case that nearly 5 million people now are barred from voting as a result of prior felony convictions, many, many of which are for nonviolent drug offenses. 14% of all African-American men in this country are barred from voting for that reason, and in the states of the Deep South, it's 30%. No other Western industrial democracy does this, and so what you have is that the way in which drug prohibition is enforced has reinstated much of the racial separation and subjugation that was a feature for 100 years of Jim Crow laws in this country.
Next up, we hear from the director of All of Us or None, Mr. Darcy Nunn.
Often I'm at these conferences, and during the course of the conference, you somehow make me feel unwelcome. I went to prison for a violent crime. My homeboys went to prison for violent crimes. And all of it was drug related. I'm at your conference and I'm knocking on your door saying, well, we passed Proposition 36 and we said for first and second non-violent people, I stood up and fought with you. I marched with you. I went from one end of the state to the other end of the state because I believed that I should have a right to control what goes into my body. My community members should have that same right. When I come to this conference and you'd only talk about the war on drugs and fail to mention that there was also a war on crime. You yielded me up in many different forms. Sometimes I feel unwelcome. Sometimes when you make me feel unwelcome, it's not your intention to make me feel unwelcome. I recognize that on the application you will fight so hard when it says, like the student loan application, have you been convicted of a drug felony? You will fight extremely hard. Would you fight as hard if it just said felony? It's a real relevant question. On the TANF application that asks about the drug felony that exclude people from receiving social services based on drugs, you will fight extremely hard. Or about the people that are excluded from public housing, you will fight extremely hard about those people denied access to public housing or housing in the nonprofit sector when they're excluded for the use of drugs. Will you fight as hard when they're excluded for stuff like criminal activity? Let's define criminal activity. And let's compare that with the presumption of innocence until you are proven guilty. Criminal activity is all that other stuff in there that they get the kickers out of public housing for. Because they suspected us but couldn't convict us. Will you fight as hard for me for simply being accused?
The winner of this year's Justice Gerald LaDain Award for Achievement in the Field of Law was given to Vanita Gupta, who worked so hard to exonerate the Tulia 45, sentenced to prison by the word of the now thoroughly discredited itinerant cop, Mr. Tom Coleman. Her award was presented by the former head of the American Civil Liberties Union, the gentleman you heard earlier, Mr. Ira Glasser. Upon receiving her award, this is Vanita Gupta.
Thank you. I can't tell you what an honor and how humbling it is for me to get this award from so inspiring an individual as Ira Glasser. It's kind of mind-boggling. I'd like to thank Drug Policy Alliance, which was actually instrumental in getting news about the Tulia, Texas cases to LDF in the first place. LDF came in later than a lot of people, and it's important for me to recognize always that there were so many hands involved in bringing justice to Tulia, Texas. George Kendall, who was my boss and my mentor at the Legal Defense Fund, Jeff Blackburn, who is a Amarillo civil rights attorney who side by side with me was a tremendous colleague and fighter by my side. The William M. Kunstler Fund that actually did a documentary that just moved me to tears and inspired my first trip down to Tulia. The Texas ACLU, which today is carrying that mantle of reform, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, getting rid of the task forces in the state of Texas, and is just doing a tremendous... is doing a tremendous job under Will Harrell's leadership, fighting racial profiling, and really understanding that the war on drugs is a war on people of color, ultimately. Thank you, Will, who's here tonight. To the number of law firms, there are a dozen law firms in Washington, D.C., New York City, and the two instrumental ones were Hogan and Hertz and Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering. You can find allies in the most unexpected of places, and that's exactly what we did. The Friends of Justice, which is a local community group in Tulia that stood and faced a lot of the wrath of the local community and stood up for what happened to the clients. And ultimately, and not least, by any stretch of the imagination, the families in Tulia, who really inspired me through some of the lowest moments in the cases where I just felt like we needed, there was no light in sight. But it was their grief and their anguish and their hope and their power that ultimately fueled the relief that came about that resulted in the victory that we saw. You know, in a lot of ways, I mention all these names because it's very important to thank everyone. But I also mention these names because it is outrageous that it took that many people to make such an obvious wrong right. There should have been no reason that it took the mobilization of incredible resources that it took a national media campaign for over a year, where the New York Times was pounding the state of Texas, and the state of Texas, the Texas media finally woke up and started really working these cases. Why did it take so much work to make what happened in Tulia, to make it right? And that's the lesson that we have to learn today, because Tulia really is the tip of the iceberg of what's going on in this country. Our communities of color are ravaged by the war on drugs. It is a crisis beyond belief. And I think it is important that the Legal Defense Fund, just like it is in 2005, still working to desegregate the schools after 51 years since Brown versus Board of Education, I can tell you that the Legal Defense Fund will not rest until the war on drugs is ended on communities of color, until we have common sense drug policy in this country. But it is time for that change. And Martin Luther King said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. Racial injustice matters. We cannot be silent about it. And this is why there are so many of us in this room doing the work that we do. Thank you.
This year's winners of the Robert C. Randall Award for Achievement in the Field of Citizen Action was DrugSense.org. And here accepting on their behalf is first Mark Greer and then Matt Elrod.
Thanks to all of you for being here tonight. The data is a little bit dated. We're now over 150,000 news articles, archived and fully searchable on any topic, and over 20,000 published letters to the editor in virtually every newspaper in the country. It's difficult to put into words how much it means to receive this prestigious award. Webster's defines this term synergy as the action of two or more organisms to achieve an effect of which each is individually incapable. I believe synergy should be the watchword and perhaps the very definition of what we at DrugSense and perhaps the reform effort in general are aiming to accomplish for the future of our movement. Synergy is also a great definition of the Internet. Combined, these two concepts, synergy and the Internet, offer a powerful recipe towards achieving our objectives. I'd like to highlight this talk by making it clear that this is not my award, but an award shared by many. For starters, I'd like to recognize Matt Elrod, the DrugSense senior webmaster. Matt started with DrugSense not long after I had the idea that writing letters to the editor might be a good way to get free media coverage on drug policy issues about a decade ago. In the ensuing years, with Matt's brilliant organizational skills, dogged work habits, and creative genius, first Matt, then DrugSense, became a reality and blossomed into the multifaceted organization it's become today. Ladies and gentlemen, I present what I humbly refer to as one of the most important drug policy reformers I've ever met, Matt Elrod.
Thank you. I want to thank Ethan and the DPA for the honor. It is a tremendous honor. I want to thank Eric Sterling for making this banquet possible. I want to thank Robert Field, without whom DrugSense would not be possible, and for also who made it possible for me to be here tonight. I can't top Robert's characterization of Mark's leadership in DrugSense. He made this at a fundraising breakfast we did the other day. He said, Mark has an ability to see talent and passion and attributes in people, and to encourage and empower those attributes and passion and talents in people, and then to get the hell out of the way. And it's interesting because we come from opposite ends of the political spectrum. He's a right winger, I'm a left wing tree hugger from the left coast of Canada. And his hands off libertarian leadership has actually worked in synergy with us lefties, who have created a socialist collective where we give to all according to their needs and take from them according to their abilities, and he doesn't realize it. So it's been especially an honor and a privilege to work with Mark Greer for 10 years now. This is our 10th anniversary, and thank you very much for giving me a chance. Finally, I'd like to thank all the organizations that have allowed me to participate in what you do, because it's a way for me to steal some of your glory and your good karma. And it's very exciting, and I've learned so much from your wisdom and from your guidance and your help and your encouragement. Thanks again.
One of the panels was, How in God's Name Do We Reform Our Drug Laws? Mobilizing Religious Opposition to the Drug War. One of the panelists was Dr. William Martin, Professor, Department of Sociology at Rice University, and one of the organizers of the International Conference on Drugs held at the James A. Baker Institute for Policy Studies.
I grew up as a fundamentalist, even though I didn't hold any revivals until I was 14. But I did start then. I have a bachelor's and master's degree in biblical studies at Abilene Christian University in Abilene, Texas. And then I went to Harvard Divinity School and graduated from there, and then got my doctorate in the study of religion, sociology of religion, but also urban sociology and racial issues. My current goal is to write articles and a book, which would be a drug policy reform agenda for religious and social conservatives. And I'm in the interim, I speak to establishment groups, to religious groups, and it's really important. Several times in this conference in these last 2 days, I've heard people say, well, we're never going to reach those fundamentalists. We're never going to reach those people on the right. Just give up on those. I think that's a mistake. And let me give you one really good reason why. There are a lot of them. White evangelical Protestants, evangelicals, fundamentalists, and Pentecostals make up approximately 27% of eligible voters in this country. They make up 37-39% of the Republican Party, and they sent 48% of the delegates to the 2004 Republican Convention. They control 18 Republican state organizations and have a substantial voice in 26 others. This is not a margin of society. This is not a minority that need not be paid attention to. If a substantial minority, I don't expect to turn the majority, but if a substantial minority of this segment could be turned to look at drug policy in a different light, that would be important. And I think there's a reason for hope on this. My conviction is that while many of these folk that I'm talking about may not recognize unfairness and may not recognize racism that perhaps we're more attuned to seeing here, but I think most of them do not want to be unfair or racist. And if we can point that out, that there is a willingness, a strong desire to do the right thing. Give you a sense of the approach I've taken, for example, on needle exchanges. We know, after giving the data on this, we know a way to dramatically cut your chances of contracting a deadly disease and then spreading it to others, including your unborn children. It would also dramatically cut the amount of money society is going to have to spend on you and those you infect. I preceded this by saying the main opposition is it sends the wrong message. And this is the message that we now send. But because we believe what you are doing is illegal, immoral, and sinful, we are not going to do what we know works. You are social lepers, and as upright, moral, sincerely religious people, we prefer that you and those in your social orbit die.
I want to thank all the good folks who participated in today's program, and here's a quick message to all you compassionate, conservative, Christian drug warriors. The drug war is a fiasco, an abomination, another dark age. Please visit our website, drugtruth.net. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guthy, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jap dancing on the edge of an abyss. Ha ha.